My first kiss. His name was James Pope. We were in the eighth grade. It was by the lockers in the hallway of Nathan Bishop Middle School in Providence, Rhode Island. He was student body president. I was vice president. He was black. I am white. We both lived on the east side. He lived on Camp Street. It was filled with black and poor people and the siren sounds answering to crime and drugs. I lived in a split duplex in a working middle class neighborhood, ethnics and multi-religious. I avoided Camp Street. I still would today. There was crime in my neighborhood too, with the neighbors above us, neighbors on either side, across the street. At some point, they were all robbed. We were never robbed. Reason, we had the best kind of security system available. We had two collies, hysterical barkers. But in that first kiss, in the hallway by the lockers, it was a darkened hallway because it was a night meeting for our student council. An exchange happened. Momentarily, our worlds converged. Across race and class and privilege, we met. He grew up with crime, a cycle of poverty. I grew up with on the edge between worlds. Doorways of escape were open to me. We were both poor, mind you. Food stamps was part of our world. Single parents, crime and drugs a part of our worlds. But college for James Pope, no. I heard he got into trouble with law in high school. I don't know if he even graduated. I was confidently bound for college, and then grad school after that, I suspected, with my white identity card held out in front of me, but I never thought about it. I look back at him now over 40 years later, and I see a young boy across race and class and culture and history. I can visit his neighborhood, but it's like another country. I might even try fully submerging myself in there and live in his world, but I will never fully understand the psychology of his culture. I never understand his perspective and his thinking unless I too grew up in that environment. There is a barrier between us that I can try and push against, but I'll never cross it. See, at core, James's brain and my brain, they developed so differently. He had daily experiences with his synapses being formed around fear and disempowerment. It was lodged into his amygdala, disconnected from his black body with a daily threat over its ownership. You want to understand the protesters in Charlotte? You want to understand the rioting and the anger, the despair? Then listen. Listen to the stories, the narrative. A wonderful author, Ta-Nehisi Coates, is inviting us to listen to his story. He wrote a gift to his son and to the world in a book called Between the World and Me. It's a journey of self-discovery from his inner city, Baltimore, to Howard University, to New York City, to the streets of Paris. His ever-expanding horizon to see the vast beauty of the black world. Yet he was always held back as a prisoner of his fears that were born in America's oppressed streets, where his body was never truly his own. Tom Griffin has agreed to read excerpts from this book.
The boy with the small eyes reached into his ski jacket and pulled out a gun. I recall it in the slowest motion, as though in a dream. There, the boy stood with a gun, brandish, which he slowly untucked, tucked, then untucked once more, and in his small eyes, I saw a surging rage that could, in an instant erase my body. That was 1986. That year I felt myself to be drowning in the news reports of murder. I was aware that these murders very often did not land upon the intended targets, but fell on great aunts, PTA mothers, overtime uncles, and joyful children. Fell upon them, random and relentless, like great sheets of rain. I knew this in theory, but could not understand it as fact until a boy with the small eyes stood across from me, holding my entire body in his small hands. The boy did not shoot. He had affirmed my place in the order of things. He had let it be known how easily I could be selected. I took the subway home that day, processing the episode all alone. I did not tell my parents. I did not tell my teachers. And if I told my friends, I would have done so with all the excitement needed to obscure the fear that came over me in the moment.
To understand the backstory of Coates's life in Baltimore, or James's life in Providence, and I do call him James in that intimate moment, I can't use his surname. But to understand the backstory of their lives, of race in America, we have to understand how whiteness has been taught to be the norm, the dominant against which all else is compared and contrasted. Another black author, Tandeyaka, who is a UU minister and theologian, she's written so much about this, and in one of her books, it's titled Learning to Be White. She shows us that blackness is forced upon the dark skin by way of separation and a hierarchy that is loosely guaranteed and based upon some sociological makeup. We think it maybe or maybe not was established and rationalized during the Enlightenment, historically theorized to be genetically based. This lie has been embedded so deep within our whiteness and our blackness and our brownness, and that gulf, though, between us and between our worlds is not even known until we collide in violence and despair. Tandeyaka tells the heart-wrenching story of Dan. Dan in the 1950s went to college and he pledged at a fraternity. It was an all-white fraternity, and he convinced his brothers that it should be integrated and they should invite a black member, and they agreed, and he did. And all was fine until the national fraternity got word of this local fraternity and what they'd done, and they said, "No, you will not be integrated, and we'll take away your charter if you try and remain so." The local fraternity caved in, and they selected Dan to tell their new black fraternity brother to leave. Dan shares this story while he's sobbing in front of Tandeyaka. 40-plus years later, he carries the shame and the pain, and he says he will carry it to his grave. Schools. James and I met in that school where racism is institutionalized. From there, he went to jail like so many other black boys. And our current incarceration trends continue. 1 in 3 black baby boys who are born today can expect to go to jail. James's blackness was legalized in courts and businesses, embedded into our social networks. And with you and me, most of us here white, it's often hidden beyond our immediate recognition because we are the norm. The schools from an early age reinforce this whiteness in small and constant messages of microaggressions and constant punishment for being less than white. I saw it in that middle school. I saw it with James, even with our limited power in the student council. See, James didn't believe he had any power, and he kept deferring to me. But by listening, by looking, to hear the stories, to see the narrative that has been carved through history, we can begin to see the pain, the anguish, the loss of hope, and the anger. Because too often we have to recognize there may never have been any hope to begin with. The agony is when they discover that the dream, that great American dream, does not exist for them. You know, the one with the white middle-class house at the end of the cul-de-sac where the children can play outside without fear of guns. That dream. That dream does not exist for so many. And the agony when they discover that the one escape route that is held out to them, the value that we hold so dear of education, that actually is just another barrier. It's a way to control the body yet another way, and to crush the spirit with that false dream, to be told to stand in line again and again.
The question was never answered. I was a curious boy, but the Sioux were not concerned with curiosity. They were concerned with compliance. I loved a few of my teachers, but I cannot say that I truly believed any of them. Some years after I had left school, after I had dropped out of college, I heard a few lines from Nas that struck me. Ecstasy, coke. You say it's love, it is poison. Schools where I learned they should be burned. It is poison. That was exactly how I felt back then. I sensed the schools were hiding something, drugging us with false morality so that we would not see, so that we would not ask why, for us and only us, is the other side of free will and free spirits an assault upon our bodies. This is not a hyperbolic concern. When our elders presented school to us, they did not present it as a place of high learning, but as a means of escape from death and penal warehousing. Fully 60% of all young black men who drop out of high school will go to jail. This should disgrace the country, but it does not. And while I could not crunch the numbers or plumb the history back then, I sensed that the fear that marked West Baltimore could not be explained by the schools. Schools did not reveal truths, they concealed them. Perhaps they must be burned away so that the heart of this thing might be known.
In that moment, with a kiss exchanged in the darkened hallway of a middle school, power was present. It's always present. Power over another. It's so simple, and yet it is so complex. In that first kiss, who had more power? James was the student body president, I was the vice president. He was black, I white. He male, I female, both in the eighth grade. And our bodies met in that moment, but understanding power for an eighth grader, not that day. But I know now, we all know now, the body is politic. The body is politic. The body, its ownership, its potential for economic power. The Civil War was about economics. Economics of who owned the power of production, the black body power machine. And we forget this at our peril. The black body is never fully owned in this country by the soul who carries it. We always have to ask, who has the power? Is it the teachers who dictate to stay in line for that child who had no breakfast that day? Is it the cop who stands there to protect us but is scared and full of biases? Is it the judge who's there to enforce justice for the body but in a system that is overwhelming and she did not create? The politicians who cannot see past their next poll or their donation check? The struggle over power, in all its complexities and its simplicity, is often about your body and my body, James's body. It's where we begin, but it's never where we end.
You must struggle to truly remember this past in all its nuance, era, and humanity. You must resist the common urge toward the comforting narrative of divine law, toward fairy tales that imply some irrepressible justice. The enslaved were not bricks in your road, and their lives were not chapters in your redemptive history. They were people turned to fuel for the American machine. Enslavement was not destined to end, and it's wrong to claim our present circumstance, no matter how improved, as the redemption for the lives of people who never asked for the posthumous, untouchable glory of dying for their children. Our triumphs can never compensate for this. Perhaps our triumphs are not even the point. Perhaps struggle is all we have because the God of history is an atheist, and nothing from this world is meant to be. So you must wake up every morning knowing that no promise is unbreakable, least of all the promise of waking at all. This is not despair. These are the preferences of the universe itself. Verbs over nouns, actions over states, struggle over hope.
You may ask about that struggle, how hard it is. It's really hard. It is really hard. It is a revolutionary need, a rebellion, because the status quo is not status. Don't try and converge this with some sort of violent rebellion. No, this is a nonviolent reaction against the violence. It's about reclaiming our bodies and reclaiming its power. Coates said to his son, "You are called to struggle not because it assures you victory, but because it assures you an honorable and sane life." He says, "The struggle is all I have for you because it is the only portion of this world under your control." Rebellion is against the powers embedded in the structures out there and in here. It is against the acceptance of our whiteness as valid, and therefore that it comes with its power and its privilege as if it's the truth. It's our struggle begins and it ends out there and in here and out there and in here. Again and again we return to the source. We want to understand what's going on in the streets of Charlotte, of Baltimore, of Ferguson, of Washington, D.C., and Chicago, then we need to understand the betrayal of an identity that's been born centuries ago, an identity that was enforced again and again under the rule of law, affirmed by the schools and written in history by the white winners, and been ignored by the white church. And yet, the ultimate twist of irony, that same identity that makes us a target, is adds sustenance through safety and numbers and tribal and familial relationships. So we are called, and our tribes, to listen to the stories across the barriers, to listen to the pain, and then believe in the stories. Believe that the pain really is that bad. And then we question how it came to be this way. We are called to raise our awareness and our voice. Tandeyaka created a game. She called it the race game. She said, I invite you to spend a week using a descriptive word, white, to any person that you're referencing, including oneself, if you happen to be white. Imagine my introducing Mark, the white guy over there. My neighbor, Lou, white guy. Hi, my name is Kate Walker, white woman. Very few have met her challenge, and very few have actually done it. Some say, I'll do that, but then come back days later saying, shame overcame me. It's hard because our whiteness is equated with our identity, our false identity that is about our value and our worth. It leads us to what we value in life, and it connects to our privileges and our power. So perhaps if we wake up in the morning and as we raise our consciousness, we wake up in the morning, each and every morning, and we look in the mirror and we ask, how will my whiteness impact my life today? What does it mean to be white in my life? And we hold ourselves accountable. No guilt, that's a waste of time. It's not about shame either. Last summer, I was going to buy some tea in a tea shop in Rehoboth Beach, and the woman ahead of me in the line was black. She offered her credit card to pay for her tea, and the cashier asked for her identification. I stood up next in line, offered my credit card, get ready to pull out my identification, but I wasn't asked for it. I said nothing. That's not who I am. The silence is not who I am. In this 21st century world, our voices matter. To understand our perpetuity, the complicity in perpetuating the privilege of our power. When we keep offering the hope and a dream that is a myth, we are perpetuating the oppression. If we really want to do this right, we have to throw the dream out. It's a lie. We have to let the dream go and give it to somebody else who's standing on the margins. We have to rip apart the myths and the lies and let somebody else tell us, what does your imagination create? One of the people that's inspired me is a UU activist, a white guy named Chris Crass. Chris Crass, he's a powerful guy. You can Google him on YouTube. Chris Crass says his consciousness was busted wide open by a friend in Los Angeles in the 1990s when the Rodney King verdict came down. And one of his black friends was in tears and began to share with Chris the daily and the hourly moments of racism that he experienced in America. And Chris heard his stories, and he believed his stories, and he began to connect his own whiteness, his privilege, his power, his assumptions, and of acceptance of all that went with his false whiteness. And he began to realize, rather than be stand there in shame, that he had power to make a difference, to be an activist, and that's what he does today. Speaking out as a white male, encouraging other white, he's not talking to black people, they've heard it, he's talking to us. Coates says, I would have you be a conscious citizen of this terrible and beautiful world. A conscious citizen. Coates is asking us to rebel against our sleep, against our ignorance, against our neutrality, against our blindness of the rage that's on our streets. If we raise our awareness, if we really look in the mirror, we know ourselves, and I will know myself. And that moment of intimacy with another human being, kiss or no kiss, I take responsibility to listen, to hear the pain, to believe the pain, to let it sweep over me and change me. The Reverend Dr. Jackie Lewis is another inspiration. Presbyterian minister, and she's creator of the annual Conference on Revolutionary Love in New York. She calls us to hear each other's stories and the songs in each other's hearts, to bear witness to each other's pain and the anguish at all the black and the brown bodies that are in our streets with bullet holes in them from their terrified neighbors and from the police. She wants us to look at all the black and the brown bodies that are in jails, all born of violence and desperation because that they discovered that the dream was false. And when people like Jackie Lewis and Coates and Tandeika, all black, are telling me, though, that there is hope, they're telling me that there's hope. This is the power of who they are and what they have been born from. When a black activist tells me there's hope, Coates writes, remember that this consciousness never ultimately be racial, it must be cosmic. And that's it. There it is. It's a faith in the wholeness that lies beneath our brokenness. It's to believe in ourselves as being whole beneath our brokenness. It is to commit to raising our consciousness, to engage as fully and wholly as we're able to, and to forgive each other and our failures. And it's to remember that none of us is alone, that we have community at our side, and that this is, in fact, how we hold each other accountable. We check each other's power. We test our psychology. We question our politics. We bear witness and we honor and respect our body's beauty and its sanctuary. In this moment, as I look back so many years ago at 2 8th graders exploring their first kiss across racial lines, across class divisions, across the eons of history that dictated our core identities, I know we met in that moment, and I let his life sweep over mine, and it changed me. In that moment is creation itself, is a source of hope. It's unfolding, and it will unfold as long as we give it the waters of consciousness, the waters of love for humanity, and the beauty that is always within our bodies. So I give you tools today, tools to take this forward, to look in the mirror every morning and ask, how does my whiteness help me today? I give you tools. In your program, you will find a wonderful brochure, Jazz, Joy, and Justice. This is Alice King's, our intern minister's initiative this year. It is powerful. Show up. Listen to the stories, hear the words, let your lives be changed. I invite you to show up as we continue our relationship with our Muslim brothers and sisters on Route 1 with ICNA. I invite you to show up when I ask you to please come to the Voice Action on October 16th at 3:30 at the high school in Vienna. I ask you to pay attention to all that activity of being involved with this community in our expo today. I ask you to practice revolutionary love, to become experts on it. And if you really want to have something challenging and exciting, go to the conference in April in Manhattan. Revolutionary love. Practice it every day till we all become experts. This is our mission. This is who we are. And this is what we dream of. A dream that we must let go of and share at the same time we claim it. And there's the messiness of life. May this be so. Amen.